Tonight on 360 North at 8, Arctic people are among the first on Earth to experience directly the impacts of global warming. On Thin Ice, the people of the North documents the pressures they face and asks what the future may hold. At 9, Constitutional Convention delegate and former Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill reflects on his decades of public service in Alaska stated pioneers in their own words. Tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Waste, and I'll be your host for today's program. Following National Native News, Lori Wilson and Andrew Bogar from the Red Cross will be here to talk about smoke detectors. And we're going to be speaking with Pat Moore and Destiny Sargent about this weekend's Amateur Radio Field Day. And we'll get details about the 4th of July activities in Douglas with Maggie Swanson and Suzanne Williams. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more live right now on KTOO News and online via KTOO.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tuesday's National Aboriginal Day in Canada was marked by sunrise ceremonies, rallies, and celebrations across the country. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, a legendary Ojibwe sniper from Ontario was honored for his role in the First World War.
Almost 100 years after he won his first medal for courage in battle, a bronze statue of Pegamagabo was unveiled in Parry Sound, Ontario. For many, this tribute should have come much sooner. He was, after all, the most decorated Indigenous soldier in Canadian history. Perry Bellegarde, the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, was at the ceremony and called Pegamagabo a warrior chief.
I wanted to be here to see reconciliation in action. And what you're doing here, you're honoring one of our great warriors, our leaders.
Critics say Pegamagabo fought for a country that didn't even recognize him as a citizen and allowed him to languish in poverty. Joseph Boyden wrote about him in his book, 3-Day Road.
I don't know whether it is because he was Indigenous or whether it was because this is honoring a person whose job in World War I was to, you know, hunt other humans and kill them.
Pegamagabo was involved in some of the bloodiest fighting of the First World War. As a sniper, he was credited with 378 kills and the capture of more than 300 soldiers. After the war, he fought for the rights of Indigenous people and was determined to keep the traditions and history of his people alive. He twice became Grand Chief of the Wasoxing First Nation and became Supreme Chief of the Native Independent Government, the forerunner to the current Assembly of First Nations. His statue shows him standing defiantly with an eagle on one arm, his right hand in a fist, a rifle slung over his shoulder, and a caribou at his feet. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Summer efforts are underway to boost the skills of Lakota language learners. The Lakota Summer Institute is being held at Sitting Bull College in Fort Yates, North Dakota. Kenzie Wagner has more.
The Institute offers free Lakota language courses, but also includes classes like Northern Plains Sign Language, Lakota Flute Teaching, or Lakota Drama. Although it's popular among teachers looking to improve their Lakota knowledge, it's for anyone interested in learning the customs of Lakota. The Lakota Summer Institute draws people from 8 reservations and 10 states. Denny Gayton is a Lakota instructor and member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. He says the Institute is one of only 2 in the country. Gayton says its goal is to create lifelong Lakota speakers.
That is the overall goal, where Lakota replaces English. Once that happens, and during that portion, there's going to be other expressions which will crop up, and they're going to end up being built upon the existing ones, patterned after the existing idiomatic expressions, which all people who are learning Lakota, they can learn during the course of their time in class at LSI.
Gayton says unlike German or another widely spoken language, there's no place a Lakota learner can go to be totally immersed in the language.
It seems like the students are just really grateful that there's a place like this, because there are so few speakers left. If we wanted to learn German, you and I could study together and we could get proficient, at least to what we think is proficient, but then we'd go to Germany. You know what I mean? We'd go to Germany and we'd be immersed in it.
Gayton says a beginner's Lakota class at the Institute is made up almost entirely of middle school age children. He says the image of what a Lakota speaker looks like is shifting from someone who's old to someone who's young. For National Native News, I'm Kenzie Wagner in Rapid City.
The Navajo Nation and the Arizona Department of Veteran Services are set to sign a Memorandum of Understanding Friday in Flagstaff. The tribe says the historic agreement is an effort to help improve services for Navajo veterans. Earlier this year, the tribe established a Veterans Administration and Advisory Council to better address barriers in reaching underserved Navajo veterans. The MOU will allow people to be trained, certified, and work for the Navajo Nation while under the Arizona Veterans Department. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at NativeNews.net. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And on this beautiful sunny afternoon, on a Juneau afternoon, I'd like to welcome into the studios two members of the Red Cross here in Alaska. We have Lori Wilson and Andrew Bogar. Now, Lori, you live in Fairbanks, and Andrew, mm-hmm. you're Juneau-based, so mm-hmm. welcome to you both.
Thank you.
And maybe first up, just a little bit about Red Cross, kind mm-hmm. of maybe big picture maybe for a moment, and then the topic for today is really about smoke detector installation mm-hmm. program, et cetera. But Lori?
So one of the things we want to kind of let people know and start thinking about is the American Red Cross of Alaska has been in Alaska next year for 100 years. We will be celebrating our 100-year anniversary.
Wow.
We wanted the original charter was in Juneau.
Uh-huh.
So we are in the process of beginning to start a plan and event for next year for that, the kickoff event for the year, and it will be in Juneau.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of putting that in people's minds and letting them start thinking about that and realizing that while it might have appeared to be, we have never left Juneau for in the Southeast or Alaska for 100 years. We've been here since before statehood.
Wow, that's got to be one of the longest running organizations in the state, I would think.
It is.
Yeah.
I can't tell you exactly where we fall in the numbers, but it's right on up there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the American Red Cross as a whole is 135, I want to say, years old. So
the date off the top of my head, I don't remember, but I do know that we started on the battlefields of the Civil War.
Right.
Clara Barton was taking care of soldiers regardless of color of uniform all the way back then.
And just real briefly, Red Cross services.
Red Cross services are, oh boy, there's so much more that we do. I mean, of course, everybody knows about the disaster side, the,
mm-hmm.
the stuff that you see on the news, you know, with the Red Cross vests, you know, during mudslides and earthquakes and hurricanes and fires. And, you know, that's what everybody associates us with. Our foundation is in our service to the military. And we are still, that is very much a part of the core of what we do as our service to our armed forces. So we have service to armed forces, international, so we respond to international disasters as well. So while we are not a part of the International Red Cross, we still respond to and deploy volunteers from the United States to international disasters and so on. We do not do blood in Alaska. Yep. That is for the Blood Bank of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one core service that we don't do here. So, you know, and then preparedness. So we have a huge focus on preparedness. It's, you know, we want people to be prepared for the event of, say, power outages for multiple years, or if you're stuck or if you're in a shelter or what have you. But also thinking about safety items at home. What can you be doing to be safer at home and to avoid having
right.
a thing like home fires, and if they do have a home fire, what's your plan? So that we have a lot of focus on that, and of course first aid CPR
mm-hmm.
that everybody associates us with as well. So, you know, beyond that, that's the big stuff. You know, we also do things like, you know, when you have mass shootings and you have things that happen within the community that nobody really thinks about, we're behind the scenes providing canteening services to the first responders, making sure they have food and water when they're responding, setting up family readiness centers where we have mental health volunteers who are making sure people are doing okay, helping process, bringing religious volunteers in to help with, you know, to meet those needs, providing the food and so on. So there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that you'd never hear about us doing that goes beyond the national media.
Yeah.
So there's
well, it's good.
A lot of depth.
That's why I wanted you to touch on it, because that's always been my sense of it, is you kind of hear the headline, but there's this whole other – there's this myriad services behind the scenes, and you mentioned preparedness is one of them, and so fire detection, smoke alarms.
Yeah, so of course I have a smorgasbord of smoke detectors sitting in my office. I just got a second shipment, and they're not doing the community any good. We've already done one installation day. We had volunteers that we brought in, and they're actually disaster volunteers. These are individuals that when I first got in here, and I've been kind of beating the drum for volunteers, they have, you know, come out of the woodworks, and we have a wonderful disaster response team now. But like you were saying, you know, that's the organ. It's really easy to find those volunteers in some cases because
the alarm goes off and people respond. But preparedness.
And preparedness is what we're really looking for now. So if maybe responding at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, when your phone goes off because there's been a house fire isn't your thing, that's okay. We need help with some education. And if you're capable of walking up a 3-step ladder and installing a smoke detector, we could really use your help. We do need teams of volunteers that will go out in the community. And the hope is by installing, they're free, they last 10 years, and we will also provide preparedness education along with it. It doesn't cost the family anything, but we're hoping to save lives, you know, in when fires happen. And you have 2 minutes to escape your house in case of a fire.
To give history to why this is important. It's a national initiative. Because we start looking at the fires, obviously the Red Cross responds to fires, and you start looking at we're the ones that are, you know, behind the, you know, they're holding the hands of the people who are watching everything be destroyed. And we've looked at the statistics working with the fire departments, and what we have found is that across the country, on average, 7 people die a day in a home fire, and that's preventable. Smoke alarms are what save. They give you that fighting chance. And so we have, as an organization, decided that, you know, we want to get smoke alarms into people's homes. We want 10-year smoke alarms because, you know, that way you don't have to worry about batteries. Smoke alarms do expire. They do have an expiration date. The sensors can start to go bad. So we want to replace those smoke alarms with new smoke alarms. And we want to make sure you have enough. And we don't want people to pay for it. We want to get it in so that they're safe. So the whole idea of this is now we're needing people, volunteers, who want to be, that might have a little bit of time, whether it's to set, maybe you only have a Monday morning that you're free, and you, but you can say, hey, Andrew, I'm available to do smoke alarm installs on Monday morning between 9 and noon. He can set appointments up with people who need it.
And we already have that list. We have a list of families.
He's already got that started, to be able to go out and start doing that. So we don't have to have just neighborhood canvassing days too. It might be by appointment when you have some time that you're able to do this, and then you're working with those families for. So there's a lot of ways for this to work, but we need people that feel that really feel like what they're doing and understand that it might not be that instant gratification, but it is. It could potentially save somebody's life.
You know, I think many people probably just assume that everybody has smoke detectors.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing that is not
that
the case.
That is not the case.
Do you have any sense, I mean, whether it's Juneau or nationally, you know, how big of an issue is this, that there are homes without smoke detectors?
No, not off the top of my head. I don't know nationally what
it
may look like. I do know from the last installation date that we had, we went through one neighborhood here in Juneau, and I was surprised. In some cases, they had the plastic unit that used to be the smoke detector, but a prior tenant, or, you know, for some reason, it kept chirping, and like, well, I'm just going to rip the wiring out of it.
Right.
They just didn't have them. And it was,
or
in
you
some
forget
cases,
to change the battery.
They had one in their kitchen, but they didn't have any anywhere else.
And is there a particular, is there a part of the community that's more vulnerable here? I mean, do you find that there's a certain part of the population that's more at risk of not having detectors that are active and functioning?
I don't know if I'd go as far as saying there's one community over another. I mean, obviously there are certain homes, types of homes that are more at risk for house fires, your older homes, trailer parks. The other thing you're concerned about is homes that are in close proximity to each other. The faster the warning, the sooner you can get out, especially if you're, you know, downtown and everyone's kind of living more closely in proximity to each other.
Right.
The other thing I'd want to seriously suggest is look at your elders. Not saying that they're necessarily more risk, but they need more warning to get out of their house.
Yeah,
severe
and that's actually what
mobility.
I was thinking, that there may be an inclination there to forget about it or not get it done.
Another community would be individuals that may be hard of hearing. That's a community where there is a specific type of smoke detector. It may be going off, but if you can't hear it, that we do have access to alarms that will actually flash lights. So you'll see the alarm, and that may wake you up well. And it actually has a vibrating unit that slides on your bed. So if you're asleep, it will vibrate you awake. However, they need to make an appointment with me way ahead of schedule so we can order those, because it takes a special installation team to do that.
So is this mostly people contacting you,
yes,
or do you do some kind of an assessment on your own?
We do two styles. We'll do a canvassing event where we'll actually just pick a neighborhood. A lot of that information is brought to us by the fire department. They've been a very strong supporter of this and say, hey, we want you to focus on this neighborhood, and we will gladly do that. That's one of the things we'd need lots of volunteers for, because it's very exhausting going door to door to door. Sometimes you'll miss families. Other times you get told no. It takes a lot of energy out of people. What's a little bit more rewarding is we put the word out there that we have these free smoke detectors. Please call us, because every time a potential volunteer would be leaving our office with, we have a kit, we have documentation they have to take with them, they know they're going to be met with success. It's less exhausting because you're not going door to door. You're going to a home that's receptive to your message, mm-hmm, and saying, yes, please give me this information. I have two small children. I'd love to talk about an evacuation route or a family meeting spot,
right,
or an out-of-state contact.
More to this than just the installation.
Right,
so
we have to be clear this. You can't call Andrew and say, I'd like to get a smoke alarm.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to just give them away.
Right.
But what we will do is we will set an appointment and come to your home. And we're not looking – what we're looking for are safety things that maybe we can point out that, you know, people to think about in terms of safety. But making sure you have enough smoke alarms, because maybe you know of one smoke alarm you need to replace, but maybe you need more.
Yeah.
And so we can
fire
identify that.
Fire extinguishers,
yeah,
the carbon monoxide.
Or more smoke alarms, because maybe you only have the one in the kitchen, but you really need one down the hallway where the bedrooms are.
Right.
So we'll install those. So it gives us a chance to evaluate what do you need and take care of that need. And then also talk about the plan for escaping and for once you're out of the home. You know, a good example is up in Fairbanks. We just did an event, a neighborhood event with the Fairbanks Fire Department this last Saturday. One of our volunteers went into a home. Just bear with me for the story. And this, she went into the home, and there was a young boy and his dad, and they were very excited to have us, but. So she starts talking to the little boy because, you know, educating children is important. And so she says, so, you know, if you had a fire, do you know how to get out of your house? And he says, well, yes. You know, and he tells her, how to get out. And she said, well, if you're in your bedroom, do you know how to get out of your bedroom? And he said, yeah, I go out my window. She goes, could you show me? And so he takes her back in the room, and in front of the window is the dresser, partially blocking the window. And on top of the dresser is a TV. There's no way, even though he knows to go out the window, there's no way he, a six-year-old little boy, is going to get out the window. So she asked Dad. She said, could we maybe move this TV over here so that the window's not blocked? And he said, sure. So they moved the TV. And then she said to the little boy, do you know how to open the window? And he said, yeah. And so she goes, could you show me? And he goes to start cranking it. And you know, in Alaska, if you don't open windows a lot, they tend to swell shut. And they don't open. And he's crying, and he's trying. And now Dad's going, whoa, you know, you see this, wow, you know. And so he goes over and tries, and it took all of his dad's strength to get that window to pop. Once it popped and opened, the little boy could open and close it. But it was this light bulb moment, and it's these things that we don't think about. We get very complacent, and we don't mean to. I mean, you just do. I mean, how often do home fires happen? And our attitudes, it won't happen to me. Unfortunately, it can. So we hope we never have to test it, but having this conversation may have just saved this little boy's life. We don't know. We hope we never have to test it. But it's just having that kind of a conversation and that reminder. So it's not just about a smoke alarm. It's about all the other pieces that come with that, and looking for those opportunities to teach and think about that eventuality. Because, you know, it's very easy to get busy in life and not.
So you need volunteers. Yeah. So how do people get involved?
Well, you can call me directly at 907-347-5841. You can email me at andrew.bogar, B-O-G-A-R, at redcross.org. You can also get onto our webpage. And I'll be honest, the best way of doing that is just Googling Red Cross of Alaska.
Right.
And there will be a link for to volunteer. And you can sign up as a brand new volunteer. However, if you do go that path, I would recommend you notify me so you just don't get lost in the cracks. Our webpage is really great. It's a lot of good information, but it covers the entire state. And if you're interested in this program, this is a critical program that could be saving lives. I need those volunteers, and I don't want you to feel like I don't want a potential volunteer to feel like they've been forgotten about. So if you contact me directly, I would recommend that. That'd be the best path at this point.
Well, thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Anything else that you wanted to mention that you haven't been able to? We just got a few seconds here, but anything else?
No, I think we're good.
I think that covered it.
Well, very good. Lori Wilson and Andrew Bogar of the Red Cross, thank you. Very important program, very important service, the Red Cross in general, overall, and this particular one with smoke alarm detection. So thank you both.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 22nd of June, 2016. It was on this day, 1944, that the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944 became law, a law better known as the GI Bill, signed into law by President Franklin D. Roosevelt, which provided a number of benefits for returning veterans at the end of World War II. Education, unemployment pay, low-interest loans for houses, farms, or businesses. It turned out to be a very popular piece of legislation, but it almost did not pass at all. The House and the Senate fought over various parts of it. Some congressmen didn't want to extend unemployment benefits to veterans. They worried it would stop people from looking for work. Other people thought that veterans would not fit in at colleges, which historically had been attended mostly by children of privilege. But Congress also wanted to avoid the sort of public scandal that followed World War I, when in 1932 poor, hungry veterans marched on Washington to demand the bonus that had been promised to them. And federal troops had to be brought in to force the World War I veterans out of Washington, D.C. So the bill passed, and it was a huge success, especially in the realm of education. In 1947, 49% of students admitted to college were veterans. Many colleges, from Stanford to the University of Georgia to Rutgers, nearly doubled the size of their student body. Of the 16 million World War II veterans, almost half of them took advantage of education programs. Before World War II, a very small percentage of Americans attended college. About 15% of people between the ages of 18 and 20 were enrolled. Most of those were from well-to-do families. And so people were surprised after the war when the veterans turned out to be very successful students. Joseph Heller, author of Catch-22, went to NYU on the GI Bill, as did Frank McCourt, the poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Norman Mailer studied at the Sorbonne in Paris. It's the birthday of the author of the great anti-war novel All Quiet on the Western Front, Erich Maria Remarque, born in Osnabrück, Germany, 1898. And it's the birthday of Harriet Mulford Lothrop, born in New Haven, 1844, who wrote under the pen name Margaret Sidney The Five Little Peppers and How They Grew, about a young widow with five perfect children. Here's a poem by Donald Hall, Summer Kitchen. In June's high light, she stood at the sink with a glass of wine and listened for the bobolink and crushed garlic in late sunshine. I watched her cooking from my chair. She pressed her lips together, reached for kitchenware, and tasted sauce from her fingertips. "It's ready now. Come on," she said. "You light the candle." We ate and talked and went to bed and slept. It was a miracle. Summer Kitchen, poem by Donald Hall from the Selected Poems of Donald Hall, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices, subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into challenging games. Learn more at lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Programming is made possible in part by Juno's Own Alaska Pure Mountain Spring Water. Available in Juno stores or delivered in 5-gallon jugs to homes and offices. 780-4262.
And I'd like to welcome into the studio David Bruce with the, let me get this right. So you're with the Amateur Radio Club here in Juno? Is that the correct name for it?
Yeah, Juno Amateur Radio Club.
Okay. And the club has the Amateur Radio Field Day, and that's this weekend?
Yeah. It's actually, it's not so much ours, it's a nationwide event that is sponsored by the American Radio Relay League and endorsed by the Federal Communications Commission. Amateur radio tends to be, we're hobbyists for the most part. We have fun doing different things in electronics, contacting people all around the world, etc. But the FCC reminds us regularly that we're here for a purpose, and that's in the event of a major disaster when all other forms of communications go down. We're generally the last resort communications for the first couple of days of a disaster, because they stress that they want us to have our standalone stations off the power grid, that we can go anywhere, set up a station, transmit, and we hold ourselves available to public facilities for this. We have an agreement with the NOAA people. We actually have a station at the weather station for communications, and we've been talking to Bartlett Memorial Hospital about having a station there.
So, excuse my cough. We'll talk about the field day in a second.
Sure.
But let's talk about amateur radio a little bit. So most people in the audience, they're listening to radio right now. Most people just think of radio as, oh, it's this thing that you turn on the radio, et cetera. This is a different – you're talking about something different, amateur radio. So why don't you just – and I think it's also referred to as ham radio.
Yes.
So talk about what it is that you do. When you're a practitioner of amateur radio, what do you do?
Okay. It's not real simple. It's like you guys, when you get involved in commercial radio, you have to get certain licenses and this sort of thing. We have to get licenses also. We're not like CBers that can just buy a unit and get on the air.
Right.
We have to study FCC law, electronic theory. We have to take some rather rigid exams before we can get a license. And once we do that, we're licensed, we get on the air, and there's three different levels of license: technician, general, and advanced extra. Each higher one gives you a little bit more frequency to play on and areas to work in.
So you, as a ham operator, when you're on the air, who are you talking to? What are you doing? I mean, what's that space that you're operating in? And
I am interested in DXing, which is distance communication, so I like to be on the air. Some people use computers and talk on a keyboard, but the idea is to talk to other amateur radio operators anywhere in the world.
So this is like a point-to-point communication with people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the fun of it is trying to get through. You can get on a computer, and you can, through internet, you can send an email message to anybody around the world. It's not quite that easy in ham radio. You have to work. You study your antennas and make sure you get the right type of antenna built for the frequency you want to use and the direction you want to go. There's transceivers run the gamut. We don't have a big stationary transmitter like you guys have. We generally operate 100 to 1500 watts, and they're pretty small units, very portable. And so we work with those, we tweak them, and the atmosphere doesn't always cooperate. And there are times when there'll be openings, what we call openings, when all of a sudden we can talk to somebody, say, in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, we try and do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they're about as far away as you can get.
So how many years have you been doing this, and how did you get involved originally?
Well, I had my first license in January of 1958. And I got it just before I moved to Alaska. And the reason I got interested in it, the group of kids that I ran around with at the time, everybody was into ham radio. That's all we did, and played with it. And I studied up, took the test, and passed. And then my father moved me to Alaska.
So there's a club here in Juneau.
Yes.
How many people are there in the club, and age range? And
we have 60 people currently in the club out of about 200 amateurs in Juneau. The range is all the way from about 13 or 14 up to someone in their 90s, 96, I think.
Before we opened the microphones, we were chatting, and I asked about younger people being involved, and you made the connection to science, that a lot of times maybe high school kids in science
right.
class will get an interest in this radio frequencies, radio waves, or what have you, and find themselves pursuing this. Is that true here in Juneau?
We've seen the young people here in Juneau do it, but the schools have not. We haven't found a science teacher or anybody in the say in the high schools that are interested in getting a license and setting up a ham station. We'd be more than willing mm-hmm. to assist them in doing this, but they need a sponsor, and then they need to be able to put up an antenna and get transceivers and stuff. But once you get the kids interested, they really get interested in it, and it's a terrible thing to say, but sometimes they drive us older guys crazy asking questions.
Well, they're supposed to do that.
But on the other hand, yeah, you're right. But on the other hand, it's fun helping
yeah.
them. But almost all of these kids that we've had in the club, and there's been a number of them, have gone on to college and ended up in the science field.
Mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
And most of them have stayed out of trouble. They haven't been in any kind of trouble. So
Amateur Radio Field Day, it's this yeah. weekend here in Juneau. So
mm-hmm.
what is that?
Well, it's a... it's a practice session. The underlying scheme of it is practicing emergency communications. We're setting up a transmitter and antennas that will be off the power grid. We'll provide our own power and transmit for 24 hours starting Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. And we'll make contacts all over the United States and Canada to try and make as many contacts as we can and contact as many of the different sectors that are United States and Canada divided up into.
Now, on the same day, are ham operators all over Canada and the U.S. doing the same things?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
This
is kind of a testing of the entire system, in a sense?
Right. That's a good way to put it. The it's the biggest event that ham radio operators have every year
mm-hmm.
is Field Day. And we have basically a social event. We invite people out to visit us, non-hams, if they're interested. We try and get people that have been hams many, many years ago and let it last. We try and get them to come out, anybody. And we will be holding FCC exams. We'll be having some training courses. We'll have a social picnic where everybody comes. Anybody can come, bring their wife, spouse, kids, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We just enjoy having everybody there and trying to get them interested in amateur radio.
So I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier. So there's this year-round, it's a hobby, you have fun with it, you are using it as you see fit, connecting with people around the world or what have you, but that there's this real fundamental reason for it, which is safety, which is public safety.
Right.
Can you just touch on that again briefly for people?
Well, the main thing is we're available in the event of a disaster. For instance, in Juneau, our club members live all over Juneau, Douglas, ends of the roads, all over the place. if we have a major disaster and we lose the radio stations, we lose the communications systems, police, fire, the state emergency system, we'll be on the air for a couple of days while all these others start to get repaired and back on the air. We'll send traffic. We practice being able to send traffic south and traffic north. Or any place else that we have to. Say it was a big thing on the West Coast, we might try and send traffic to the Midwest to pass emergency information. We'll help people let relatives know that they're okay. We'll pass emergency messages like somebody may need, say, 100 cots or 1,000 cots brought in. And there's a lot of other agencies that swing into effect. I believe the ferries have amateur radios on the vessels. They would be enlisted to, for instance, to bring a lot of supplies into Juneau to help, that sort of thing. And we would communicate with all of them.
We've got just a minute or so left. Anything else about the radio field day coming up that you want the general public to know? I mean, if people want to get involved or learn more about it.
The field day is being held courtesy of the Capital City Fire Rescue, Chief Eldridge, but it'll be at the Fire Training Center, which is across from DMV on Sherwood Drive. It's the big gray building that looks like a prison. That's actually the Fire Training Center where people learn how to fight fires. We invite anybody that wants to come. Former hams, people are interested, anybody just wants to see what's going on. We recommend somewhere between 12 and 5 on Saturday as being a good time to come. The first couple of 3 hours we're having a picnic, so if they come, we'll give anybody a hamburger or a hot dog, something like that. We'd love to have them come. We're going to have some demonstrations of things. If anybody really wants to get on the air and talk, we'll put them on the air.
It's exciting.
It is. Some people are afraid to, but it's really once you do it, it's kind of addicting. Once you get on the air, man, you really love it.
And you realize what you just did, talking to somebody from somewhere else on the planet or what have you.
But anybody's invited. We'll be there for 24 hours. If anybody comes, you come into the training center, turn right and go over to the brown building where there's a big tall tower that will be up, 100-foot radio tower with a big antenna on the top. There's going to be a fire training class in the training center, so we need to keep the two separate.
Okay. But anything else you wanted to mention about the field day and or just the amateur radio club here in Juneau?
Well, just one thing. The if anybody's interested in amateur radio, we have a luncheon every week on Wednesday at noon at the Safeway Deli. Anybody's invited to come. We had two people stop in today from the Lower 48. They just happened to be up here as tourists, and they stopped in to talk to us. They were happened to be ham radio operators. It's a pretty exclusive club, and in the United States, there's only 725,000 amateur radio operators. So out of 300 million, it's kind of fun, and it's a totally different world.
Very good. David Bruce, thank you for dropping by and teaching us all something about amateur radio.
Well, thank you, Jamie. I appreciate it.
Come and listen in to the radio station where the mighty hosts of heaven sing. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
If you want to hear the songs of Zion coming from the land of endless spring, get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
And listen to the music in the air. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Heaven glory share. Heaven glory share. Turn the lights down low.
Turn your lights down low.
And listen to the master's radio. Get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Come and listen in to the Gloryland chorus. Listen to the glad hosannas roll.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Get a little taste of love eternal. Get a little heaven in your soul. Get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
And listen to the music in the air. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Heaven glory share. Heaven glory share. Turn the lights down low.
Turn your lights down.
Thank you. This is Bird Note. Laying and incubating eggs is serious business for wild birds. Some birds, such as swifts and albatrosses, lay only one egg. For ducks and quail, 10 to 12 isn't uncommon. The female of these species lays one egg per day, until the clutch is complete. And the parents wait for at least half of the clutch to be laid before they begin incubating. That's so all the eggs will hatch about the same time, a process that can take as few as 11 days to as many as 11 weeks. Ducklings, goslings, and other waterfowl spend up to 30 days in the egg, so they're able to walk, swim, and feed themselves as soon as they hatch. We call these chicks precocial, because they seem to be mature beyond their age, like precocious children. By contrast, the chicks of pigeons, robins, and most songbirds spend less time, perhaps only 2 weeks, maturing in the egg. They hatch blind, naked, and helpless, and must continue to develop in the nest before heading out on their own. We call these hatchlings altricial, needing to be nourished, since they depend upon their parents to feed and protect them. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Precocial or altricial? What were you?
Okay. excuse me. Maggie Swanson and Suzanne Williams?
Yes, Suzanne.
Suzanne Williams are in the studio, and they are with the 4th of July Douglas Committee. Is that the correct committee?
Douglas 4th of July Committee.
I almost have it right. But the reason why I'm thrown off is they got these, like, fireworks things sticking up out of their heads, and they call them sparkly dealy bobbers, so I was trying to write that down to get it right. But you look very festive. Red, white, and blue colors here. Looks like fireworks. And, of course, 4th of July is coming up. And we all know what an incredible community this is to be in and around the 4th of July. Rain or shine, it's always a total blast, and Juneau proper has a lot to do with that, and Douglas, of course, proper has a great deal to do with that. So tell us about what's coming up on the Douglas side of the festivities.
Well, on the Douglas side, we actually start on Friday, July 1st, and MJ Grand has been promoting the sidewalk chalk contest that the library does in conjunction with the Douglas 4th of July committee. So at 4 o'clock, all the kids can use chalk and draw great pictures all up and down the sidewalks. And if it's raining, it'll be in the parking garage underneath. And at 6 o'clock, there'll be a light supper. So that's kind of the first lead into the 4th of July activities.
Now, I'm totally lost on the calendar. When does the 4th fall this year?
Monday.
Okay,
yeah.
So the 1st is on
Friday.
Okay.
Friday.
So
events
start on Friday.
Yes.
Very good.
And then you have a little bit of a break on Saturday. And then on Sunday, we have the Soapbox Challenge registration and trials. And so this year it's not mandatory, but we do encourage the kids to go ahead and do the trials. They'll be from 6 to 7:30 up on St. Anne's Hill. And also at 6 o'clock, we start with a community picnic. The Douglas Volunteer Firefighters and the Douglas 4th of July Committee put on a big community-wide picnic and provide hot dogs, hamburgers, and all the goodies that go along with that. We also then have the big watermelon eating contest for all kids who, from the age of 1 on up, if they can eat a watermelon, they can be in the contest. And we have a lot of fun with that. And that starts right at 6 o'clock at the same time as the picnic.
This is Sunday?
This is Sunday, yes.
So this is still in advance of the 4th of July.
Leading up
to
the 4th, right.
And so then after the kids get all filled with watermelon, and then we have a sand dollar contest. We sprinkle sand dollars up and down the beach and have different areas where the little kids get to go and find the sand dollars. And they have a blast doing that, and, you know, all the way to the water's edge, and just all kinds of activities to get them geared up for the 4th.
Mm-hmm.
And that all takes place at shelter number 1 at Sandy Beach.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we reserve it. And things are divided into age groups, particularly the sand dollars. They mark the beach in different units, so at least, you know, the little ones have a chance to find sand dollars before the 10-year-olds get them all.
Understood.
And they get a reward. If they turn their sand dollars back, they get a special reward. If they turn them back rather than taking them home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a little bonus.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and then, correct me if I'm wrong, so Sunday night will be the fireworks?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So Sunday night are the fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously from anywhere in the downtown area, wonderful vantage points, including
mm-hmm.
from Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So then the next day.
So the next day, this year we are fortunate to have First Student providing bus transportations back and forth from Juneau to Douglas. They'll be leaving starting at 11 o'clock and running till 5 o'clock. So they'll be at the Federal Building and then Gastineau School so people can ride back and forth without having to worry about taking their own vehicles, which is wonderful.
Yeah, it occurred to me that for anybody who's brand new to Juneau,
mm-hmm.
There's a downtown parade, and then the festivities and the events all shift over to Douglas for
mm-hmm.
a long afternoon of wonderful
mm-hmm.
events, including a parade.
Yes.
So what you were just talking about was to help solve the potential transportation issue of getting from one's, you know, most crowded day of the year probably on the road
yes.
system, right?
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yes. Yes, and our parade, we line up at 1:30, and our parade starts at 2 o'clock. The children's parade meets at the north end of the Gastineau School in that big parking lot, and we encourage all kids to come and decorate themselves, bikes, trikes, wagons,
their
scooters, go-karts, and just to come and have fun and be a big part of the parade.
So do people already have to be signed up for the parade, or is it what you're saying, Douglas style is show up and you get to be
parade.
In the parade?
And our Grand Marshal is Betty Marriott this year, and she's a retired Gastineau School teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And has been very active in other things in the community, like the hanging flower baskets downtown
mm-hmm.
Juneau.
Yeah.
And she was very active in working on the program of the empty chair.
Mm-hmm.
Which was done this past year or so, 2 years ago.
So the parade is kind of the formal kickoff of the 4th of July proper events. But then there's a whole host of things that happen.
So as you walk down to the beach, well, the parade goes along St. Anne's and then turns down to the beach, and that's where it ends right there at the Montessori School. And on the way down, we have the Douglas Community United Methodist Church has a barbecue. That's their fundraiser of the year, and they have a great food there. Then we move a little bit farther down, and the Douglas Fire Department has a hot dog sale. Then we keep going down to the beach, and as the parade ends about 2:30 or so, our field events for all the races for the children, ages 2 on up to parents, starts at 3 o'clock at Savico number 2. And you have the little itty-bitty kids running 10 yards, and then we end up with a sack races with parents and children. And so all ages in between, we have just regular races. We have three-legged races and sack races.
I'm laughing. We've all been there. We've all done these.
I remember doing them when I was a child.
Some people do them every year.
And you should mention the prizes that everybody gets.
Every child, and the same with the Douglas Parade. All of the children get a dollar to participate, and then the winners in each category get $5. Down at the races, all of the children that participate get a silver dollar, and then the first place person gets $5, the second gets $3,
something
and then $2.
Yeah.
So first, second, and third, I'll get monetary awards.
And this is just the tip of the iceberg. I can see other events.
Absolutely.
I know of other events that are also in store for people.
Sandcastles. We forgot the sandcastles.
The sandcastle contest starts at noon down on the beach, just right down there. There's a high tide at 2 o'clock of 16 feet, so you don't want to build too far down because it'll be washed away before they judge at 4 o'clock.
Right.
And part of that is sponsored by the Southeast section of the American Institute of Architects, and that's an annual event.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of fun to go check out all of the sandcastles
mm-hmm. before the tide takes them away.
So hold off or build high up on the beach.
Right.
At the same time as the field events, we have the Soapbox Challenge finals. And that's a blast. If you folks have not gone out and watched these little kids go down that hill, you need to go do it.
And the Dipstick sponsor that, and they're looking for volunteers that can come either on Saturday or Sunday or Monday for just even a couple hours to help them out with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Kimberly Vaughn, and she can be reached at 209-3635 if anybody can help out.
Other events?
Well, as all of these events are ongoing. You can't forget the food court that we have sitting in the Treadwell parking lot, and that we have
you spend the silver dollars there.
Very good.
Exactly. So we have a slew of vendors this year, and I don't have all of them, obviously, because they haven't all signed up yet, but COPA will be there. Fat Mo's will be there. COPA will have ice cream, Fat Mo's, pulled pork. The Filipino community will have a chicken barbecue and salad and goods. Front Street Cafe will have fries, cotton candy, barbecue pork sandwich. Helping Hands, this is one of their major fundraisers. Hot dogs, chili, chips, drinks. The Doghouse will have hot dogs, and V's Cellar Door will have tacos. So bring your appetite. There's all kinds of great goodies to have while you're wandering around doing things. So right as we're moving down again at 3:30, we hit the Super Dog Frisbee Contest. Mm. So
always popular.
Oh, always
it's
popular.
A blast to watch.
Big, big crowd pleaser, this one.
Mm-hmm. And just make sure that if you're going to enter your dog, but you have the 2016 license. And it's a $10 registration fee, and it's one of the biggest hits, I think, that we have.
Yeah.
Then at 4 o'clock, we're moving back up to the fire department, the fire station.
We have
the old-time fireman's hose race, which...
And it's another crowd pleaser.
Absolutely.
Yes, they love it. They love it.
And if it's raining, everybody gets wet, and they already get
so,
wet.
But explain for people what that is, because if they've never seen it before, it's a hoot.
Okay, well, the firefighters have different areas in town, and so then you'll have groups from different areas of town compete against each other, and they'll each have a rolled-up hose, and they'll tie it, section it off, run down the street with it, and loop it together, and then turn around and shoot water at the other team. So whoever gets their hose all put together and tied up to the water source first is going to spray the other team and all of the people in the crowd behind them. And so it's a big competition as to who gets done first and then also to see how wet they can get the other people.
Well, there's a crowd participation element here as well.
Absolutely,
whether you know it or not.
Yes, yes, right.
Part of the event.
Yes.
And then the children, you got that bouncers, bouncy houses.
The Barefoot Bouncers will be having, I think, around four different types of bouncy houses for little kids, and they have one this year that's even small enough and safe enough for little one-year-olds. So any kid that used to sit there and say, I can't go in because I'm not big enough, now can participate. So ages 1 to 12, and they can be reached at 209-4041, and they'll just be set up all day. And again, it's weather permitting, because if it's pouring down rain, then it's not going to work.
Right.
Wind also is a factor some years. If the wind's really blowing, that would make a difference.
And then we have Alaska Music One presenting bands on the beach, and we have bands from 4 to 9 o'clock this year.
Mm.
At 4 o'clock, the Shriners are going to be doing a drawing, so instead of the band starting right at 4, they'll come up and they'll do their drawing for their fundraiser. And then at 4:15, the Rusty Link Band will be performing until 5 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, Soul Review takes over. 6 o'clock, Alex K. and the Unmentionables. 7 o'clock, Wilson's Vacation. And 8 o'clock, the High Fives. And the last two, Wilson's Vacations and the High Fives, those are weather permitting, because if it gets really nasty and it's getting worse, then they won't be performing that late at night.
Right, right. Is there more? That's a lot.
That's a lot. We do have a few other non-food vendors. The Alaska Wildlife Alliance will be having a booth down there. Jay's Jewelry and Novelties. She sets up her fair jewelry and goodies. And then Northland Bible Church is set up, and they'll be handing out water.
Yeah, they hand out water.
So this is a huge undertaking. Do plans for 2017 start like the day after the 4th of July?
No, it starts in April.
In April?
April we start. We're a very short-term committee.
That's great. Yeah. So starting April, you pull
April,
all this together.
We have our annual membership meeting and get our board members going, and we're done. The last week in July, we have a wrap-up meeting, and that's it.
Oh, you guys. That's a good committee to be involved with.
Yeah.
Well, we do. I just want to do a quick shout-out to Tyler Rental, they handle the porta potties for us. And
yes.
Parks and Rec, the CBJ Parks and Rec Department, takes care of the whole field area down there and draws the lines for the fields and races and takes care of all of that. And the streets department guys, they take care of cleaning up and all of that.
Major
so
community
a lot
involvement
of community
to make
involvement.
It happen.
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
There is. And let's see, Ike's Fuel clears parking lots so we can put bleachers up.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have the little plaza in front of the little water wheel plaza, as it's called. We put chairs for seniors to sit in, about 20 chairs or so put there. So, yeah, there's a lot of other people that help us out.
How many years has Douglas been doing this?
Over 100 years.
Over
100
years.
We had our 100th year back in, was it 1999, I believe, our 100th year.
What a great tradition. So for people who've never gone to Douglas for this, that alone should be a compelling reason, let alone all the activities.
This is the 118th annual 4th of July program.
So that's how long
we've been doing. Congratulations to you and the committee members for keeping this going. So thanks to all of them and all the volunteers that are involved.
We also, one way we started off, though, is thanks to the volunteer firefighters of Douglas, we do a Flag Day decoration, which is always on the 14th of June, no matter what day of the week it is. And we have a contest for businesses and homes and nonprofits and apartments and condominiums, asking them to decorate in patriotic colors, and the firefighters go around and they judge, and then we have the winners, and we ask them to keep their decorations up through the 4th of July, but mainly we ask everybody in Douglas, if possible, to hang put their flags out, and it was a wonderful participation this year. I think there were over 40 homes that just had flags alone, which is wonderful. And then many decorations, which is fun to drive around, take a look, and see what people have done.
So we've
it's a
got
big community event.
Just about a minute or so left. Mm-hmm. And if there's anything else about 4th of July specifically that you want to talk about, I want to.
Well, we've got one other thing we do. We put on a Christmas tree lighting, always on the Friday after Thanksgiving. And this year it'll be at the Douglas United Methodist Church and their lawn. We'll put a tree up in their lawn and decorate it, and that will stay up through, I think it's January 16th, the Greek Orthodox Christmas. And then on the same time, we have the tree lighting, and then we all go down to the arena and have the children, 12 years old and under, skate free with Santa Claus and his merry elves, and that includes the skate rentals. And we do that every year.
And your organization's also been involved with projects over the years. I guess just
people need to know.
There's,
oh, yeah, we built the ice arena.
Yeah,
we started. Yeah. We spearheaded that. And then we also built the Pioneer Pavilion, which is down in Savico Park. Mm-hmm. And the other thing we did for that 100th year celebration, we got the total state grant for Arbor Day. And we planted maples on one side of the street and crab apples on the other. And that was for our 100th year.
Yeah. And we've also, we have a fundraiser. We hold a raffle every year. And the funds that we use for that go to help put on the 4th of July events. I neglected to mention that the field events are handled by the Thunder Mountain Track and Field Team. They're going to be using this as we're paying them to run the event. So they'll have some money for their travel. You know, we've bought skates for the little kids' skates for the rink. We've contributed to the roof of the pump house.
Yes, right. And we gave weed whackers to a gentleman, Tony McCormick, who takes care of the historical cemeteries around Douglas.
Mm-hmm. So, great organization to be involved with. We've been Suzanne Williams and Maggie Swanson, both of the 4th of July Douglas Committee. Did I get it right?
Close enough.
So, thank you for your work, and I look forward to seeing you perhaps in the crowd on the 4th of July in Douglas. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
We
encourage everybody to come on over to Douglas.
Yes.